a regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Mark Walters from Armed American Radio here in just a moment or two. About the I don't even know what to call it. The back and forth, I guess, between some Second Amendment groups, some Second Amendment advocates, and the DOJ, particularly the head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division, Harmy Dillon. There's been some criticism of the DOJ's position in cases. We talked about this with with Brandon Combs of Firearms Policy Coalition last week, Reese versus ATF. That's the case where the government did not ask for a list of members of FPC or SAF, or Louisiana Shooting Association, but they did want to apply relief to a very limited subsection of that membership. That prompted National Association of Gun Rights and a couple of other groups to proclaim that the government was taking position that they wanted to establish a list of gun owners. That's not really the case. And in fact, the DOJ came out and filed a joint motion to amend what the judge had put in place, which did require these organizations to turn over a list of their members, at least those members who would have been impacted by this decision, allowing 18, 19, and 20-year-olds to purchase handguns at retail. But it's not just the Reese case. Brandon last week said that it's pretty clear to him anyway that the administration's position is that state-level gun controls are bad, federal gun control laws are good, that they are defending virtually every federal statute that is being challenged right now. Harmy Dillon, who's the head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division, spearheading the efforts going against L.A. Sheriff's Department for delays in concealed carry. She argued against Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Has been pushing back on social media against these accusations that Pam Bondi is not 2A friendly enough, that the DOJ is not 2A friendly enough. And I respect and admire Harmy Dillon a lot. And it's, you know, we'll get into this with Mark, but I think two things can be true. This DOJ can be the most pro-Second Amendment DOJ in modern history. And it can take positions that are contrary to the Second Amendment advocacy of groups like NRA, GOA, NAGGER, FPC, Second Amendment Foundation, Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Arms. Both of those things can be true. The question I think then becomes, what do we do about it? And that's what we'll kick off the conversation with Mark Walters from Armed American Radio. Take a look and a listen. Mark, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to talk with you, sir.
Oh, thanks for having me, Cam.
Absolutely. I'm glad you're here because I want to talk about something that has sort of blown up on social media over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, maybe. We started out, I think, with National Association for Gun Rights calling for Pam Bondi to be fired. We've seen criticism from Gun Owners of America about some of the positions that DOJ has taken in federal cases. I had Brandon Combs from FPC on the program last week. And he said, you know, it's pretty clear that DOJ is taking the position that state-level gun control laws are bad. Federal gun control laws are good. Talking about the laws that they have been defending, right? Particularly the NFA. You got the suppressor case. I think it's Peterson, which the DOJ has said, $200 tax stamp, that's a modest burden on our Second Amendment rights. They are asking the Supreme Court not to take a case called Rush versus the United States, which deals with short-barreled rifles, arguing that the Miller case basically prevents any challenge to SBRs going forward, but also that special taxes on at least some firearms are a part of the national tradition of gun ownership. And so, Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, who's the head of the Civil Rights Division, who's doing fantastic work. And none of this is to dismiss or, denigrate the work that the DOJ is doing to defend our right to keep and bear arms. But she has pushed back against this criticism that the DOJ is not 2A friendly enough. Most recently, Jared Yanis from Guns and Gadget talked about the Rush case. And she kind of responded to this, saying that You know, the infighting doesn't advance our agenda. Hang on, should have turned this off here before we started doing the interview, but how that is.
You're reminding me to check mine too. It's on silent. We're good.
Somehow over the past week, man, I've started getting more and more spam calls. It's ridiculous.
Darn phones.
I know, right? So I'm just curious to get your take on this because, you know,
oh boy,
where I fall down is, or where I come down, I guess I should say, is yes, this is the most pro 2A DOJ in history. At least as Costas Morris from SAF said, going back to the Grant administration. That is undeniably true.
Yes.
It is also true that the DOJ is defending the NFA, right? Mm-hmm. It is defending, or at least, we'll see what happens with the gun bans for 18 to 20 year olds. They did not appeal the decision in Reese versus ATF. Right. Nor, by the way, did they request that gun owners turn over a list of all of their members, or the Second Amendment organizations turn over a list of all their members. We can get into the weeds on that one if we want. But I think it is fair to say that the DOJ is not taking on every gun control law. And in fact, they are defending a lot of the federal laws on the books. That can be true at the same time. It can be a true statement that this is the most 2A friendly DOJ that we've seen, certainly in our lifetimes.
Yeah. So thanks for bringing me into this mess. Let me start with this. I'm not going to sit here and disparage any of the pro-gun rights groups, okay? And let me go back to my Sunday show with Gottlieb. Alan took me by surprise live on the air on hundreds of radio stations on Sunday when he made it very, very clear. And viewers and listeners, I want you to go back and listen. I don't have the audio clip. It's too long to play here. But nonetheless, I want you to go back and listen to Armed American Radio, to the podcast. You can find Armed American Radio on any of your podcast platforms that you use. I would hope that you would subscribe as well. Or you can visit armedamericanradio.com and listen to last Sunday's first hour, the first couple segments. Mr. Gottlieb made it very clear. He was specifically referring, Cam, to the Reese case.
Okay.
Which is 18 to 20 year olds and the list. But this, he said this was a unilateral decision by the judge that the DOJ and Pam Bondi are in no way seeking a list to create a federal gun registry, period. He made that very clear. And he went as far as saying, Mr. Gottlieb did, and I want you to go back and listen to it, folks, so you can hear it directly from him, that the Gun Owners of America and NAGGR, National Association of Gun Rights, owed the DOJ and Pam Bondi an apology for putting out misinformation. He said it was utterly 100% false. And he said, you know, we rag the gun grabbers constantly when they lie, all the time. And when we do it, we need to hold ourselves to the same standard, and they owe an apology to Pam Bondi and the DOJ. Now, he was referring specifically to the Reese case, Cam, okay? Not the Rush case, the short-barreled rifles, none of that.
Right.
So those are Mr. Gottlieb's words. He got it out. I'm not here to challenge him on the airwaves because that's not what my show is all about. I want him to be able to say what he wants from his perspective, period. And quite frankly, at the moment that it came out, I was not in a position and didn't have anything in front of me that I could have anyway.
Right. So, well, and I mean, listen, going on memory here, I think Alan is right that what GOA and NAGGR said about the DOJ wanting a list of gun owners, that is incorrect, right? So the Reese case, again, this is that Fifth Circuit case. We were talking about it with Brandon Combs last week. The DOJ did ask for a very limited relief, right? They said, okay, fine. If 18 to 20 year olds can, if that law is unconstitutional, we want this ruling only to apply to the named plaintiffs in this case.
Correct.
And members of these associations who would have been impacted when this case was filed 5 years ago.
Right.
And they did not ask for a blanket list of names of members of the Louisiana Shooting Association, FPC, or SAF. The judge kind of took it on himself to say, okay, yes, you've got to provide this information to the government. And since then, DOJ and the Second Amendment groups, the plaintiffs in this case, have actually filed a joint motion to amend this judgment, saying that instead of shall provide, that language should read may provide. And the DOJ explicitly said, look, we're not in the business of trying to, you know, establish membership roles for these organizations. Mm-hmm. So I think Alan's right about that.
No, he is. And let me add to that.
Yeah.
Put this in perspective. Because as you mentioned, this case was filed 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what this judge unilaterally was looking for, without input from the DOJ, as you just pointed out, Bondi and the DOJ have said that's not what they're looking for. They are in agreement with the SAF that the judge was wrong. That's according to Mr. Gottlieb. I'm in no position to dispute that. I wasn't in the courtroom, and I'm not a lawyer. So I want to make that very clear. This is the understanding that I'm getting in conversations with him about this. But what's important to point out is, if the judge were successful in this, he's seeking the SAF roles going back to kids who would have been 13 at the time.
Right.
Okay. And so I absolutely agree that there's no way in that particular issue that it's even feasible to do. And according to Alan, the DOJ is not seeking that. Now, regarding the other cases, there's a quandary here. And I don't know how I'm trying to articulate the word. Is it a quandary? Yeah, it is. Because you pointed it out at the outset of your opening statements here. And that is, you've got the most pro-gun administration in American history, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not familiar with one that's been any more pro-gun than this administration. Are they perfect? No. Is anybody perfect? No. None of us are. The absolutist in me says, when you look at Trump's executive order, to go back and review all of these boneheaded BS cases, then why is... Now, keep in mind, the vast majority of these cases were filed during a Biden administration. So why is the Trump DOJ defending these cases that were brought by the, you know, so they're in this position that forces people like us to take a really hard look at this deeper than we would have in a previous administration, because we would have expected it with a, you know, with a DOJ headed by the Biden administration. Here we've got Bondi pro-gun, everything's pro-gun. I say Bondi, a lot of people will dispute she's pro-gun. I will say this, she's far more pro-gun than anything previous to her. So I'll give her that. All right. We can debate how pro-gun all day long. But I think it's safe to say that she's the most pro-gun AG this country's had in a long time, particularly over the last 4 years. That's a fair statement. And why they're doing this and continuing to fight, I don't have any idea. I can't even begin to offer a response when you're familiar with the executive memo from Trump specifically saying to go back and review these cases.
Mm.
I can't make heads or tails of it. But I don't feel like I'm in a position at this point to be disparaging anybody until I know more, and I don't know enough right now, which is why I deferred back to the Reese case because of what Alan said, and I went back and spoke with him about it and researched that, and I'm very comfortable with making the remarks I just made. But I'm not Gottlieb, I'm not in the courtroom, and I don't have a clue. I'm not ready to go off the deep end and call for somebody to be fired, but we definitely have to get an answer to this. There's no question about it.
Well, yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, I think I'll just be really blunt here. I think it was a mistake for Nagar to call for Pam Bondi to be fired. I don't think that I think Trump has every confidence in her. So I don't think it's going to happen. So I think you look politically impotent when you make a call that is not going to play out well.
Sure, I agree with that. I agree
from that perspective. But also, too. All right. So who do you replace her with? I mean, let's say Pam Bondi does get fired. Who do you replace her with? Is there a guarantee that the replacement is going to be any more pro 2A or take a different position, right, than what the DOJ has taken in any of these cases to date? And I don't know that the answer is yes, because I suspect that these positions are not being taken by Pam Bondi alone, that, you know, it's sort of a delegation of authority that there are many, you know, several people at least deciding, okay, what is the government's position going to be here? And, you know, and as for the not the Reese case specifically, but the issue dealing with the Reese case, 18 to 20 mm-hmm. year olds. So the government, you know, they took the loss of the Fifth Circuit and they did not appeal that decision to the Supreme Court, right. Which is something that Harmy Dillon has pointed out. There are, however, a couple of other cases out of the Fourth Circuit where the Fourth Circuit upheld mm-hmm. these prohibitions on handgun sales to 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. Now, the government doesn't have a choice, right? It was the Second Amendment groups that appealed these cases to the Supreme Court. So the government's going to have to weigh in.
Yes.
At some point. In fact, I think they're going to have to weigh in next week. I think the reply briefs are due on October 20th. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wrote at Bearing Arms yesterday, this will be an opportunity for the DOJ to actually take a position where they aren't defending federal statute.
And that could be strategy here. I'm not Mark Smith.
Right.
I'm not the constitutional attorney here. There's a lot of nuances going on behind the scenes. Here's what I will say about all of this, just in a broad brush deal. I'm going to revert back to the absolutist in me. If Pam Bondi and the DOJ are talking about this behind the scenes and are defending this level of federal gun control, we need to know about it. Okay. Now, look, the RNC contacted me. I think you were on that list as well. The task force during the campaign, the 60 names on that list. Why are they not reaching out to us? Where's the input? They've never spoken to any of us on that list. That list is 60 people deep. Some very prominent names on that list. And they've never reached out to any of us. Well, I don't know where they're getting their advice. Now, I can speculate. I'm pretty sure I know of about one or two names, but I'm not positive, so I don't want to name those names. You know, I'm disappointed that we don't know more than we know. And I'm also disappointed that I can't offer really anything else as a talking point on this until we do. I'm not ready to make that knee-jerk reaction yet, because we are dealing with a very pro-gun administration. And I don't know what the strategy is in the courtroom going forward and what the DOJ is attempting to do and what cases they want. Maybe they want, you know, obviously we all want to get these cases to the Supreme Court. That's why we're filing circuit splits all over the place. We've got 55 active cases at SAF right now.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I went back as far as Alan, and he's got so many cases he couldn't even remember the one I was talking about, and that's being able to buy a handgun across state lines. He said, Mark, honestly, he goes, I don't even know where we are in that case. Right? These things take years to play out, sadly.
Yeah.
So you're right.
And a lot of these cases that you mentioned, a lot of these cases were filed under the Biden administration. But again, we have seen even in Reese, you know, the government's original. No, sorry. This is I get confused, too. This was Peterson.
Peterson case. Yeah.
The guy which was dealing with suppressors. The DOJ back in March said, filed a brief with the Fifth Circuit saying, well, suppressors aren't protected by the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of outcry.
Yes.
And the DOJ actually walked that brief back and said, actually, you know what? We've reconsidered in light of President Trump's executive order. We've reconsidered the government's position. We now believe that suppressors are protected by the Second
Amendment. Okay. Okay. But
and then they went on to say, but the $200 tax stamp is okay because it's just a modest burden.
Correct.
Exercise of a Second Amendment right.
There's two buts in here, okay? Mm-hmm. And the operative words that you just spoke were because of Trump's executive order. What if it weren't for the executive order?
Right.
Would the DOJ have continued to push this? They had to reconsider it in light of Trump's executive order, to quote you.
Mm-hmm.
What if there was no executive order? Well, here's the thing. There is. So in light of that, why are we even talking about these cases when they shouldn't be there to begin with? You see, this, you know, again, I don't have the answers to this. It's frustrating to me because all of those, you know, any gun control is an infringement on the Second Amendment. Any gun control, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I believe I ought to be able to buy whatever I want to buy out of a vending machine as an American citizen, law-abiding citizen. And that includes a fully automatic weapon if that's what I want to choose to own, because I'm not a threat to anybody. All right? But I'm also a realist and a pragmatist, and I understand what's going on in the ground, and I understand that we're going to have to fight some of this. I get all that, and I know it takes years. It's maddeningly frustrating, particularly if you don't live in a free state like I do, and you live behind the blue wall. Believe me, I get it. The absolutist in you becomes absolutely more absolutist behind the blue wall because you've got, you know, your life's ticking by and your rights are being infringed upon, and these cases are taking years. Gavin Newsom just banned Glocks and signed, you know, HB 1127 in California. You know, the absolutist in me says it's high time for the firearms industry as a whole to band together and say, you know what, California, we're not selling anything to California anymore, including and particularly law enforcement. Let them all feel the pain. Now, that's my knee-jerk reaction. The realist in me says, okay, step back and take a breather. We'll just have to fight the commies in court. And the NRA is spearheading it. All the groups are going to join in, and we're going to win the case. But guess what? By the time we do, Gavin Newsom isn't worried about it. He thinks he's going to be in the White House, or at least running for the White House. He's not going to be the governor anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's leaving the citizens of California in the lurch and in the dust. This is a maddeningly frustrating thing that is we all want it now and we want it yesterday. Believe me, I get it. I'm there. I don't know. It's enough to drive you crazy in a more positive sense. It's job security because it's constant content for us. The left will never stop. And then you throw in these questions and the frustrations with the administration. And why is a Trump DOJ not just saying, no, we're not going to defend this. Get rid of it. So why are they defending it? You know, is some legal nuance there that we're unaware of? Like I said, more of a question for Mark Smith than me, frankly.
Well, I will. We'll see if we can get Mark on the program. But I always appreciate your insight too. And you know, my bottom line is, like I said, this is the most pro Second Amendment administration that we've seen, including the DOJ. But as you said, they're not perfect.
Yeah.
And you know, as Second Amendment advocates, we have a duty to speak up when we see even a friendly administration doing something that we think is wrong. It doesn't mean that we are, you know, tarring and feathering that administration, that we're calling them, parts of the gun control lobby. But I think, you know, again, we have a duty. Like I love Harmeet Dhillon. I think she's doing fantastic work. But I'll be honest with you, it rubbed me the wrong way when she criticized Jared Yanis for criticizing the DOJ's position in the Rush case and said that, friendly fire doesn't advance the ball. The Civil Rights Division is doing is fantastic, but yes, it is unfair to think that Second Amendment advocates are going to bite their tongue.
Correct.
And hold their lips when they see something that is inconsistent with a pro Second Amendment position.
And why, you know, why would, I'm curious as to why in this particular case, does she not expect us to question this? That's why we exist. Okay. It's our responsibility to question this. Jared didn't do anything wrong. You and I both know Jared. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
You know, it is his job. He's made it his job to question this, and she should respect that. I didn't appreciate that, which is why I'm not going to sit here and attack the GOA and Nagar and Harmeet Dhillon. And I'm not going to, I don't want to get down that rabbit hole because I understand what she was saying with the friendly fire doesn't advance a position. Look, the one thing, sometimes we are our own worst enemies, right? We feed the enemy sometimes. I don't want to fight. That's why I've set my show up the way I've set it up. I'm not going to sit here and do red meat radio going back and forth with Gabby Giffords and some gun control goofball, you know, that just pisses a lot of people off and they just get rid of the shot. This is an opportunity for us to advance what we want to talk about, okay? From our position, conversations like this are critically important. This is not friendly fire, Harmeet. This is a conversation, a legitimate conversation, asking legitimate questions about why this is happening when none of us believe it should. And if you're watching, Harmeet, here's the deal. And Pam Bondi, there are a lot, and I can provide you names of some great Second Amendment attorneys that can advise you on these cases. Okay, maybe you need to start talking to some of them before you get out ahead of your skis, which Bondi is very good at doing. Maddeningly, frustratingly so sometimes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, that's why I was bothered that we, as a part of that member task force, we never got asked anything. Nobody talked to us about anything. It was frustrating. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah. And understandably so. And this is, again, this is frustrating as well because again, I think I think we need to be able to have these conversations. It doesn't mean that, I don't think Jared Yanis called for Pam Bondi to be fired, right? I think you can have a reasonable discussion, you can have a reasonable disagreement without automatically going to these extremes.
Of course.
And that's how you move the ball forward, quite frankly. But it involves having those conversations like the one we're having right now. So Mark,
friendly fire is a good thing from time to time, if you want to use her words, because it opens up this discussion and opens up people's eyes to what's actually happening and the frustrations that we all face.
Absolutely. Mark, as always, man, I appreciate you coming on the program. Love joining you on Armed American Radio. And folks can find the show, probably on their own local radio station, but also at armedamericanradio.com, right?
That is correct. Yeah, everything is there. And we'll have a new updated list with the affiliates coming up on that page in the next couple of days as well. It's been a little bit outdated, but armedamericanradio.com. And please, guys, subscribe to Armed American Radio podcast on your favorite platform. And I appreciate it. See you on the radio. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mark. My thanks to Mark for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. I did, by the way, reach out to Harmeet Dhillon. I think it was last week. I don't know if the DOJ's press office is operating during the shutdown, but I invited her onto this program as well, because I would love to have a substantive, in-depth discussion about the good work that DOJ is doing. Again, I'm not trying to minimize or mitigate any of that work that the DOJ is doing in defense of our Second Amendment rights. But you can't ignore the positions that the DOJ has taken in cases like Rush. Or even, you know, we talked about this with Joe Greenlee yesterday, the Vincent case, where the Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, this is Melinda Vincent, the woman who wrote a bad check 17 years ago and can't own a gun because of that. The administration's position is, well, we've got this new relief from disability program, so the courts don't need to weigh in on whether or not these laws are unconstitutional because she can apply to get her rights back. Well, no. I mean, that program's great. I hope that it is very beneficial in helping people restore their rights, but that's not the question, right? The question is whether or not the federal statute, which requires someone like Melinda Vincent to lose their Second Amendment rights because they were convicted of a felony that is punishable by more than a year in jail, even though she was sentenced to probation, whether that statute is constitutional or not. And I can understand, you know, maybe this is something that is just common to governments, right? Governments defend the laws that they put on the books. It is extraordinarily rare for an attorney general like Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer to decide he's not going to defend a state gun law. It would be extraordinarily rare for the DOJ to say, hey, you know what, we're not going to defend the NFA. Hey, you know what, we're not going to defend these statutes. Now, we can argue that that's the right thing to do, but I think we also have to acknowledge rarely is that done. I'm all in favor of blazing trails, though. And again, I think we'll see what happens with McCoy versus ATF. I forget the other Fourth Circuit case dealing with 18, 19, and 20-year-olds and their ability to buy handguns in retail. But the government's brief is due there on October the 20th. I think that there is historic work being done at DOJ, but there's always room for improvement. And I hope that the DOJ officials will take this criticism by Jared Yanis and others in the spirit in which it's offered, which I think is you're doing a good job, but you need to do an even better job. You need to do more, not because we're greedy, but because a firm defense of the Second Amendment compels you to. Anyway, all right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day. And our recidivist report, we will start there with a case out of Vermont. Topsham man sentenced to time served in aggravated assault case. This individual already on probation at the time of this aggravated assault case. According to the Times Argus newspaper of Barre, Montpelier, Vermont, 24-year-old Arthur Butler pleaded no contest last Friday in Washington County Criminal Court to a felony count of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and a misdemeanor account of simple assault on a law enforcement officer. He was sentenced to 20 to 21 months to serve, with credit for 21 months served. He had been held on $10,000 bail since his arraignment in December of 2023, so he's out now. Butler also admitted to a probation violation and had his probation revoked in a case where he shot another man in the back. He was sentenced in that case to 40 months to 10 years to serve, with credit for time served, and he will essentially be out, if not already, within a matter of months for violating the probation that he originally received for shooting a guy in the back. So this is my issue here. Why did he get probation for shooting somebody in the back in the first place? In April of 2022, he pled guilty to a felony count of aggravated assault and misdemeanor counts of reckless endangerment and violating conditions of release, which means that he was already out of probation, or at least out on bond, at the time he was arrested. He was, at that point, sentenced to 40 months to 10 years, all suspended except for 40 months to serve, and then he was placed on probation for 8 years. So he didn't even really serve that 40 months. In this case, Butler shot a man in the back in 2019. Butler was 17 years old at the time. The victim reportedly was left paralyzed. Excuse me. Police say that the shooting took place after an argument, saying that Butler had pointed a gun at another man when the victim tackled him. The pair fought until Butler shot the victim twice. In the most recent case, a family member apparently had taken Butler to the Barre Police Department and said that Butler wanted to turn himself in, had a knife on him. Butler then apparently pulled a knife on the officer, started running around, quote, ran at the officer while still holding the knife. A stun gun was deployed against Butler. Butler fell to the ground, dropping the knife. Butler was able to grab the knife again, though, but the officer stepped on his hand, causing him to drop the knife. Officer said the Butler resisted arrest, hit the officer in the chest, continued resisting, but was eventually taken into custody. So, and apparently the family member said that the Butler had made numerous statements about suicide by cop in the days before this incident. So, you know, I question, what does it take to not get sentenced to probation for a violent crime in Vermont? Vermont is great. Well, they had great gun laws. They've started putting more gun control laws on the books in recent years. But again, I don't understand why Butler got probation in that first case. I guess maybe he was arguing it was self-defense. But if he was the initial aggressor and pointing a gun at somebody when his life was not in danger, then the person who got shot was trying to defuse that situation, trying to de-escalate that situation. And then again, you know, this most recent incident, probation revoked in the first incident. So maybe he does 40 months, but he's already done at least 21 months behind bars. So we're talking about 19 months time off for good behavior. You can probably cut that down in half. So 19 becomes what, 9.5 months. I don't get it. I don't understand it. And, I suspect that, prosecutors in this case are pretty frustrated as well, although it should be noted they did accept this plea deal. In fact, they offered the plea deal to Butler in both these cases. On to today's armed citizen story from the Sunshine State of Florida. Resident shoots at armed man during Miami Gardens home invasion, police say. This was, I think it was yesterday, maybe Monday morning. Armed with a rifle, the resident opened a bedroom door. I got that backwards here. According to the Miami Herald, there were three individuals who entered this residence. One of them armed with a rifle and opened a bedroom door before the resident grabbed a gun of his own and fired, striking the armed intruder in the arm. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue paramedics took the wounded man to a local hospital. Police said the alleged intruder's condition unknown as of Monday afternoon. They haven't released his name. They say that the shooting remains under investigation. But again, based on what police have said, three armed individuals enter somebody's home. The resident shoots one of them. That to me, clearly in self-defense. We'll look for any follow-ups here, but I would be shocked if the resident is facing charges for firing the shot of the armed intruder. Now, who knows, there might be underlying charges of, you know, legal possession of a firearm. We don't know the circumstances. But as far as the actual act of pulling the trigger, no, that pretty clearly sounds like a justifiable case of self-defense. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time will enable to do the right thing. A good Samaritan who was able to save a life in the state of Indiana, Batesville, Indiana, the dateline for this story. Good Samaritan dispatcher save man from burning car. Which, you know, we run across a lot of these stories in our Good Deed of the Day segment. I had no idea that this many car fires happened and that there were this many Good Samaritans, quite frankly, who were willing to put themselves at risk of harm in order to save another life. Robert Chamblin says he was driving along a country road outside of Batesville. This is back late August. When he saw a car lose control, flip over into a ditch, and then catch fire, Chamblin said, you know, there was no one else there to help him, and he needed help. He said, I would hope that someone would do the same for me. So Chamblin called 911. He saw the flames start to spread from the bottom of the car. He was connected with a dispatcher named Tim Costello, who, according to WLWT, guided Chamblin through a rescue. Chamblin told Costello, there's just one person. He's getting out of the vehicle. I'm going to go help him out of the car because there's smoke and there's flames coming from the bottom. He put the phone down in order to help pull the driver away from the burning vehicle. Tim Costello stayed on the line waiting for several minutes. Finally, Chamblin said the driver was safe and about 40 to 50 yards up the hill from the flames. Costello told Chamblin, all right, Robert, good job. We've got everyone coming for you as quick as we can. It was, I think, last week that Chamblin and Costello actually got a chance to meet in person. The Ripley County Sheriff's Office honoring Costello with a life-saving award for his work as a dispatcher during that emergency. Tim Costello said of Robert Chamblin, he did an amazing thing, and I was very inspired by his actions. I felt he needed the recognition. Robert Chamblin, though, said, look, I helped the guy one time. He said, dispatchers like Costello, they do it every day. These guys deserve all the respect and the recognition in the world. I think there's more than enough praise that can go around, right? That's not in short supply. So both Tim Costello and Robert Chamblin in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing for a stranger in need. And we thank them both for their very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Barry and Arms, Cam and Company. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk with Barry Todd. We talked with Barry at the NRA annual meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, earlier this year. A nightmare story of self-defense for Barry Todd. He acted in self-defense, but it was a legal nightmare, is what happened afterwards. So we're going to get an update from Barry. He's got a book out, came out a few months ago. I think it had just come out, actually, when we talked to him in Atlanta. He has been hearing from a lot of folks around the country who have either been in similar situations themselves or who are concerned about finding themselves in a similar situation. So I thought it was worth having Barry back on the program. Looking forward to that conversation tomorrow. In the meantime, be sure to check out BarryandArms.com today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. New lawsuit filed in California against the Glock ban. Adam Tate Adamiak, his appeal mostly denied, and his convictions mostly upheld. I have the latest for you on that as well. And if you are so inclined, you can head over to Spotify or YouTube.com, do a search for Cam Edwards, Dial Up Hearts. I have a new song out about Miss E and me meeting back in the 1990s. One of the things that I've alluded to over the months previous about just kind of using music to help me get through losing Missy. I'm going to put out more music next week on her birthday, but put out a first song today. Check it out if you are so inclined. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe.